Hi, everybody. This is Micha Sifri of Personal Democracy Forum, and we're on for another of our ongoing series of PDF Network conference calls with movers, shakers, thinkers, and innovators in the politics and technology space. This week, we will be continuing our summer book series with Cyrus Farivar, who is the author of a really terrific new book, The Internet of Elsewhere. In a second, I'll be bringing him into the call. First, I just want to thank AT&T, our ongoing sponsor for these PDF Network calls, for helping make them possible, and remind people who are listening that we will be following your tweets on Twitter if you use the hashtag PDF Network. So if you want to sort of track the conversation or throw a question in or comment in, use that as your hashtag. For the first half hour, it'll just be me and Cyrus, and then somewhere around the middle of our hour, I will open up the call to your questions and comments and thoughts. Please make sure your phone is on mute for the time being, and I'll signal you when it's time to get into the question and answer queue. So I have to say it's a pleasure to have Cyrus Farivar on the phone with us. Cyrus, I have followed your work for many years, especially your reporting on the politics of the internet in relation to Iran and the rise of the blogosphere there. And I heard about your book, I was very glad to see that that somebody like you was really tackling this problem of expanding our awareness of the development and impact of the internet in places outside of the sort of well-covered, path of, the U.S. and the major countries of Europe, that to really go beyond that scope to places like Korea and Senegal and Estonia and Iran, of course, that it's a real contribution to our overall knowledge about how connection technologies are, developing in different paces and in different ways and affecting societies in some ways that are familiar and other ways that are not so familiar. So, I'm really looking forward to this next hour with you as we dig in a bit on the stories you tell in the book. But maybe, the first thing to do is I want to invite you to tell us a little bit about your background and how it is that you came to write The Internet of Elsewhere.
Sure. Well, I wanted to just thank you, Micha, and thank you, Marcia, for having me as being part of this discussion. It's always a pleasure to share my work with such a thoughtful and intelligent audience. As you said, my name is Cyrus Farivar. I am an Iranian-American journalist. I currently live in Germany. I am speaking to you now from Cologne, Germany, which is about a half an hour outside of where I live in Bonn. And the reason I live in Bonn is because I work for Deutsche Welle English, which is Germany's international radio broadcaster. And I have a weekly program in English on European science and technology news, and I host a program. It's called Spectrum. You can download it on podcast if you like. You can just search for DW Spectrum. But anyway, yeah, this book began a few years ago. I suppose you could say really it began way back actually in 2002 and 2003 when I was still an undergraduate at UC Berkeley. I spent my junior year abroad that year, 2002-2003, in Senegal. And that was the first time I'd been there. It was the first time I'd been anywhere in Africa. And I lived there as a student. And I spent a lot of my free time in cyber cafes, not only because I am kind of an internet junkie, like I think a lot of us on this call are. It was really fascinating to me to kind of watch how people use the internet, because in a place like Senegal, most people use the internet in cyber cafes. A lot of people don't have access at home. Some people have access at work, but, fewer people have access at home. So Cyber Cafe is really a way for most people to have access. And, and I wanted to kind of understand how and why the internet developed the way that it did in Senegal. And I ended up writing my undergraduate thesis, actually, about the Internet in Senegal. And later on, when I was in graduate school at Columbia, this kind of morphed. I started thinking about more of these issues. And really, I think, for me, one of the early points of inspiration was reading an article in the Christian Science Monitor. This was in 2005, that was talking about how in Estonia they had declared internet access as a human right. And this was totally kind of shocking, but in kind of an exciting way. I mean, first of all, I was
Cyrus? Okay, we may have just lost your connection. Sorry about this, folks. This is the nature of using Skype. We'll hang on a second and wait for Cyrus to redial back in. In the meantime, I'm going to open up the Q&A if anybody has anything they want to say in the meantime. We are having technical difficulties, and we're hoping that Cyrus is going to be able to dial back in.
Mika, we just got an announcement that the Q&A session is over. Does that mean you can't hear us?
No, I can hear everybody. If you're listening on the call, the other folks are on. We can all chat right now while we're waiting for Cyrus to get back in. I thought I'd clear the hold on conversation. I'm curious if you've read the book, if you have specific questions or observations that are on your mind about the book. Feel free to jump in.
Hey, Mika. Alex Howard here. I have read it, and as with your book, The Age of Transparency, I really appreciated the more global perspective, reaching far beyond the issues that people are dealing with domestically in the U.S.
Yeah, to me, that was what was really eye-opening and confounding slightly, because it really shows that there are other paths to development. I'm hoping to get into those questions with Cyrus here. If he doesn't manage to get back on, we may have to reschedule this call. It's such an irony to be relying on technology to talk about the impact of technology. But yes, I mean, the way that the sort of hyperspeed and ubiquity of connections in Korea, for example, a country where, they would scoff at the degree of broadband access that we have here in the United States, how that has played a role in altering political trajectories. That's one of the themes that comes up in the book quite strongly. But also the sort of dark side in Korea, the whole topic of internet addiction, which apparently is a more serious phenomenon than I had been aware, assuming the data that Cyrus cites is accurate. Hang on here. Let's see. Other people who read the book with any observations? Comments you want to share?
Apologies.
Ah.
Hey, sorry. I don't know what happened. All of a sudden my internet just died. I'm on a friend's computer and I don't know, maybe it's the lightning or something. I have no idea.
All right. Well,
anyway.
We mugged for the cameras for a little while there.
Okay.
And and started talking about your book. But let's get back into the train of the conversation.
Okay.
In terms of the inspiration for you in pursuing the subject.
Yeah, so I was talking about Estonia, and I was talking about how I was, had heard about how the internet was declared a human right in Estonia, and I wanted to figure out, again, how and why did this happen? And of all places in the world, why Estonia? Why this tiny country of 1.3 million people that I think few people that I myself knew nothing about? And so this was kind of the seeds initially of looking at these countries. And then Iran was tacked on, both for personal reasons, because I have family there, my father's from there, but also, of course, because of the interesting kind of political history that's been going on in Iran over the last especially the last couple decades, you know, and kind of how the internet has evolved there in terms of political speech and blogging and all the rest. And then South Korea, because South Korea is the world's most wired country. It has the most widespread, cheapest, and most easily accessible broadband access of anywhere in the world.
So what I was starting to say, the thing that first struck me most in the book, and, you know, I'm going to, like, do a very quick, you know, sort of broad set of reactions, but the things that jumped out to me, I mean, in the case of Korea, you know, the impact of, you know, ubiquitous, high-speed, affordable broadband, you know, let's talk about Korea for a little while. It may be the most advanced internet-enabled country in the world, though Estonia obviously sounds like it is up there too, but Estonia is a much smaller country. So let's put that to the side for a second.
Okay.
I mean, in terms of Korea, you know, what would you say, I mean, are we looking at a place that's, you know, this is a harbinger of what America might be like if indeed we get to, you know, gigabit broadband streams at cheap prices. I mean, what I got from your picture of Korea was a place where, you know, in some ways politics is sped up, you know, media is transformed. You know, we see an outsider politician manage to break through with a great deal of help from, you know, what today we would call, you know, online social networking. You know, what we saw there happen, you know, presages what took place for Obama back in 2008, and this is back in 2003 in Korea. So there's this kind of speed up and intensification of, you know, grassroots populism in politics. And the other thing I got from your section on Korea, which surprised me, was the degree to which internet addiction, you know, that having this cheap, plentiful supply of you know, high-speed crack, if you will, that it's a real problem. And, you know, that it's enough of a problem that you know, it's been recognized and you know, it's being dealt with as a syndrome there. I mean, am I exaggerating in those readings, or do you think that, you know, that's the takeaway you would take from, you know, what you learned about Korea?
Well, I would say that you have it. Yeah, that's true. That I think that I just tweeted actually, Marcia, if you could, I forgot the hashtag, I realized, but I just tweeted actually
PDF
an
Network.
Article. Right. I just tweeted an article from the New York Times that's dated May 5th, 2003, and the headline is "America's Broadband Dream is Alive in Korea." And the article basically talks about how high-speed internet access has pervaded throughout Korean society, and in many ways the United States is still lagging behind, you know. Like you said, I think that what's interesting about what's been going on with respect to Korea, both in terms of, like you said, on the political side, and what Misha is referring to is, there was this presidential campaign a few years back that was organized actually initially in a what's called a PC bong, which is like a Korean equivalent of a cyber cafe. And it's funny because there was this political group for a guy who later on became president of Korea, prime minister of Korea, a guy by the name of Romu Hyun, and there was this political kind of group, a fan club, if you will, that was called Rosamo, which is a Korean acronym that means people who love Ro. That was the guy's name. And their first meeting place was actually in a PC bong, in this cyber cafe, where lots of Korean kids, boys mostly, would come and play computer games and just kind of hang out. And it struck me that maybe, I don't know if this is too much of an exaggeration, but it reminded me at least of kind of the role that 19th century Parisian salons played in kind of amongst a certain kind of intelligentsia class that, you know, that was the venue that they chose for their first meeting. And I think that's very telling of Korean society in terms of being this very, very wired place. And yeah, and on the one hand, that's great. You know, people can get together, people can organize, people can establish political discussions, can use social networking and all that stuff. But as you said, also there's a great negative side, which is that yeah, you have some strong examples of internet addiction. You have people who, again, young boys who are using the internet so much and playing these competitive computer games so much that they become isolated from the rest of their normal lives. And the Korean government has opened up a series of psychological places where kids can go to get treatment. And even there are these camps, these kind of therapeutic camps where you can go and, you know, they send these boys and they learn about basketball and chess and campfires and stuff. And you know, and they're just kind of away from the internet for a while, and they learn how to be kind of normal kids again. And it's really interesting. We haven't seen that as much, or you know, at all. I guess you know, to the same degree in the U.S. But I do wonder though, you know, if maybe there's something there that we need to watch out for if we take this kind of to that extreme.
I mean, the effects that you describe of the internet in Korea, you're talking in a number of cases of things that happened a couple of years ago. Has it kind of hit a plateau, or would you say that, you know, we should still look at Korea as giving us a picture of what the road, you know, 5 or 10 years ahead might look like for us here or for people elsewhere? I mean, you know, politics there seems to have sort of absorbed this phenomenon now. It's not, you know, the bloom's off the rose, if you will.
Right.
The specialness of it. I mean, that the candidate that you talked about, he ultimately, you know, he fell into some disgrace and committed suicide later, right?
Right, that's true. That's true.
I mean, it's a strange story. So I'm just wondering, you know, if what other lessons you would tease out about the Korean example, and you know, not to be culturally prejudiced or anything. I think we can learn from many cultures, but is that degree of internet ubiquity, does it make it a more attractive place to live in your mind? You know, were you as an internet junkie yourself? Was it for you just like being in paradise, or did you find it overwhelming?
In some ways, I mean, I'll give you a good example. The very first moment that I was in, that I arrived in Seoul, I got on the subway. I was coming in actually from a different city doing interviews for this book. In fact, this was April 2007, and I had just come in off the bus from a town called Daejeon, which is about 2 hours bus ride south of Seoul. And I went back to Seoul, and I got on the subway. And one of the very first things I saw was a man in a business suit. He had clear, you know, he appeared to be coming home from work, and he was standing there in the subway, holding his mobile phone on a moving subway car. I don't know how many hundreds of feet underground, moving it. I don't know how many miles per hour, but you know, fast and far underground, watching a live baseball game on his mobile phone. And as a baseball fan, I thought this was great.
Yeah.
You know, and I, at the time, I was living in Oakland, California, in the Bay Area. And the Bay Area, as you know, likes to pride itself on being kind of the tech hub of the United States and in some cases the world. And, you know, and at that time, at least, you couldn't even send a single text message on the BART going between Oakland and San Francisco. And here this guy was watching live baseball over his phone on a moving subway car, you know, and that just really blew me away. So I think that has kind of pervaded. People take it for granted, you know, that you can do that. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to ask a sort of policy wonk question, which is, and who owns the infrastructure? Is this all government? You know, I mean, just to compare again, is this because they had, you know, a sort of central government plan to make this level of broadband possible? Is it from competition? I mean, you know, in a nutshell, what should we take from Korea's success in reaching that level of internet service?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at how the internet has been deployed in Korea over the years, yes, there was a deliberate government plan in many cases. In fact, a lot of the reason why there is so much broadband to access, there's a couple reasons. One is Korea, as you know, I mean, by geography, Korea is a small country, especially compared to the United States. I mean, I'm pretty sure New York State is bigger than all of South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, you have much less geography to deal with. So that helps. The other thing is that most Koreans, the overwhelming majority of Koreans, live in kind of dense urban environments, right? They live in apartment high rises in big cities like Seoul, Daejeon, Busan, and other places like that. And so this last mile problem that we have in many parts of the United States, where it's, you know, it's difficult to get access to people who live in remote areas, is less of an issue. So I think that's kind of one advantage to them. Another thing is that, you know, they made a point of really encouraging companies of the government creating companies and then as a way to kind of spur competition in the early 1990s to bring broadband access out to everybody to make it available. They in fact used initially some fiber optic cable that had been laid as part of the power company, the national power company, KEPCO, the Korean electronic and power company, I think, or electricity and power company, I think it's called. And they had kind of some dark fiber, if you will, and they were able to use that for internet. And it was laid initially just as kind of an internal corporate network. It wasn't initially designed to be part of the national kind of internet infrastructure. And I think something else that's kind of interesting is that the Korean government has also made a big effort to create, and I talked about this a little bit in the book, to create something called New Songdo City. They've basically reclaimed this bay up not actually very far from the North Korean border in a place called Incheon, which is where the Seoul International Airport is. And this is designed to be this U-city, this ubiquitous city. It's an artificial city designed to have networking technology, RFID cards, electronic payments on your mobile phone. English is going to be the main language. People can file building permits and business permits in English, you know, and they're really doing it as a way to kind of attract international business and immigrants and saying that, well, you know, we're close to the major airport and this kind of thing, and this is this kind of futuristic city. We'll see how that kind of pans out. I mean, it's still being built. It's a massive, massive project. But it'll be interesting to watch how that goes.
Well, let's turn to the other example in the book of sort of ubiquitous internet connectivity. You know, I think of this as another place where maybe we get a glimpse of the future, which is Estonia. Obviously, much smaller, 1.3 million people, as you describe. And, you know, the book, I should say, by the way, we're not giving you enough credit for, you know, having unearthed and explained the history of the development of the internet in places like Estonia and Korea. I mean, you really do get to meet the sort of far-sighted engineers and entrepreneurs and government players, who through one way or another – end up being the key people who, lead their country's development. It's really one of the reasons this book should be on your bookshelf. If you are, like the folks listening, you know, an internet politics junkie. In Estonia, the big story there, I think, for those of us who are interested in how the internet can transform and modernize how government works and how citizens interact with their government, is the degree to which they've seemingly embraced a fairly robust kind of e-government. I wonder if you describe for that, you know, describe that a bit. You know, how do things work there? It isn't just that they've moved to the option of online voting in elections, right? I mean, there's there's a great deal more in a number of ways where the government is genuinely integrating connection technology into how it actually works, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, and so yeah, there's a couple things to consider. One is on the government side. There is e-voting, and I'll get to that in a moment in Estonia. So every Estonian can vote on the internet from wherever they are in the world using their Estonian digital ID card. I'll talk about that in a second. But yeah, on the government side, there is this concept of what they call e-parliament or e-government, and what that means is it's really changed the way that the Estonian government establishes or writes legislation. So in order to understand this, you have to first just briefly understand how the Estonian government works. So in the U.S., we have Congress, and Congress proposes bills, and then they get sort of reconciled with the Senate, and then they go to the president's desk, and he signs them, right? And that's how laws get made.
Glad you cleared that up, by the way, because
that's what I learned during Schoolhouse Rock when I was in fifth grade. anyway, but in Estonia, what happens is they have a parliamentary system, and so there's a cabinet of ministers. So you've got the Minister of the Economy, Minister of Transportation, Minister of Defense, and all the rest, and the Prime Minister, of course. And so each minister can propose a bill within the cabinet. And so they want to propose a defense spending bill, or they want to propose some new transportation construction, or whatever it is. And so they discuss it amongst themselves. And once that passes the cabinet, then it gets passed on to the parliament, and then the parliament votes on it. And then if they approve it, then it becomes law. And so what happens is they decided several years ago in the early part of I guess now we're in the second decade of the 21st century. So in the first decade, in the aughts, I guess, they said, well, you know, we're printing out all of these documents. Actually, I think it may have even been earlier than that. Anyway, I have to look it up. They decided, you know, we're typing up all of these laws and these bills and these proposals. And then we're printing them out, and we're coming to these meetings, and then we're putting them back online, and this is just silly. Why don't we just have an entirely electronic system? You know, why don't we discuss these bills online before we discuss them in person? And so, in a matter of months, this system was set up using Linux boxes, and the meeting, the room that where they have these cabinet meetings is, you can imagine, just kind of like a U-shaped conference room. So they've got tables and chairs, you know, around, and then the cabinet ministers are sitting there, and then they got their aides behind them. And so if you can imagine this U-shape, at each station, there's like a Linux box stripped down, and it's you know, you can't do a whole lot with it. But one of the things that you can do with it is you can access the government's online discussion board. And so the idea is that bills are proposed, and even if a minister, you know, whether they're in the room, whether they're at home with their family, whether they're, you know, on somewhere else in the world, they can log on to this website and see the text of this bill that's being proposed. And the rule that they established was, they said, okay, if bills are not worth being discussed online before the meeting actually convenes, if people decide that this is not worth discussing online and no one is going to contribute any kind of discussion, then basically, we're in agreement that it's okay. Nobody has voiced any opposition, so it's going to pass, right? And so that meant that a lot of bills that would have taken more time that were relatively uncontroversial, that would have taken more time to discuss in person, automatically passed. And they told people who work in this environment told me that these meetings that used to go an hour and a half, 2 hours, sometimes even longer, typically now are under an hour. So they kind of streamlined that process. That's just on kind of within the government. And then later on in 2002, 2003, the Estonian government got going with this digital ID card project where every Estonian citizen and legal resident of Estonia has a digital ID card. So if you can imagine, just like your American driver's license, it's about that shape, and it's got your name and your photo and all that. But it's also got a microchip in it. So for people who've maybe spent a little bit of time in Europe, you may be familiar with the European bank cards that have the chip and pin system. So it's basically an ID card like that with a little chip in it. And what you do is you hook it up to a little USB card reader, you plug it into your computer, and just like you would log onto your, you know, Bank of America, Citibank, whatever bank you have, a kind of online access website, imagine kind of a citizen's portal where, you know, it logs in and it says, hello, Misha, what would you like to do? Would you like to pay your taxes? Would you like to pay your speeding tickets? Would you like to receive parental benefits for your new children that were just born? Would you like to pay your student loans? Or you don't have student loans because you live in Estonia. almost any government service that you can think of, you can do through this online citizens portal. And one of the things that you can do is vote. And you can do this, of course, just so long as you have an internet connection and physical access to your ID card, because that's kind of how you're authenticating as you. And basically they're using a well-known in the cryptography community, they're using what's called a public key, private key scenario. And this is used in many other types of cryptography for secure email and other types of things. So this is well understood. They weren't kind of creating anything out of scratch here, but they said, okay, we're going to have this system and people can use it to do all kinds of services. One of the most interesting ones is vote. And so they held the first internet-based presidential election, national election, in 2007. And I find this really interesting, you know, because in the U.S., as we all know, there's various voting standards in different states. And I think it's funny that in the U.S. we can barely get paper voting right. And in Estonia, they've just moved on to internet voting.
Yeah. The question I have about Estonia, and I'm going to also open up the call soon, so folks listening, if you're hankering to jump in, you could hit *6 and get yourself into the Q&A queue. But the question I have about Estonia is, it sounds great on paper or on, you know, in the ether, if you
will.
On
a screen.
On the screen. But are people really using it? I mean, two, 3 years ago, I was invited to a conference on, the Internet and Politics 2.0 at the University of Holloway in England, and there were a bunch of academic papers being presented, but one of them was very interesting. It was on Estonia, and Estonia happens to be, you know, it's hard for us, if you don't speak Estonian, to access the real, you know, sort of lifeblood of democracy there. I mean, it sounds like they've done some amazing things to take advantage of inherent capabilities in the technology. But this paper, one of the things it pointed out was that this option for citizens to engage with the legislature, and even, you know, if enough people signed on in support of a proposed bill, that would force the legislature to at least consider it. That the actual design interface was not very good, and that there was very little training of the bureaucrats inside the legislature whose job it was to sort of deal with citizen comments, and so that while the surface looks shiny and beautiful, that the actual practice there was a lot lacking, that it hadn't really, led to a flowering of the different kind of civic life. And I know, you know, it may be hard to get at that, as an outsider reporting on a place like this, though you obviously spend a lot of time there, and you really do profile many of the key people. But, you know, can you get at that? And I don't mean the workings of government. Is that different? I mean, obviously, you know, they've streamlined some bureaucracy, it sounds like. But in terms of how the average person feels about, you know, whether they have, a more open and two-way kind of dialogue with their elected officials or with government public servants. Can you give us any sense of how it might be different or how it might be better than what we sort of take for granted with modern government bureaucracies?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think, just because, you know, you can vote on the internet doesn't mean that everybody does. I mean, I was just trying to pull up the results from the most recent election in Estonia. And this is from, I'm looking at the Wikipedia entry here that is citing the official Estonian kind of electoral results. But, you know, they're indicating that, you know, less than 10% of Estonians took advantage of being able to vote on the internet. So just because you can doesn't mean that you do or that you have to. You know, there's no law that says you have to do it this way. I think that what's interesting about Estonia is that it's a good example of, you know, oftentimes in the technology world we talk about leapfrogging technologies, and you know, and Estonia is a country that really was devastated by the Soviet Union during its half century of occupation, and you know, and that's true, I think, in many cases. And I think when Estonia, as I like to say, kind of rebooted itself in 1991, 20 years ago, when it became independent from the Soviet Union, you know, then things like, I think, mobile phones were able to take root much more quickly because very, very few people, relatively few people had landlines, you know, so these kinds of things could come about. But, you know, I think that for some of these things, I don't know that it changes how people feel about their civic participation. I don't know that, again, just because you have, you know, just because you have internet voting doesn't mean that you will vote online or that you will vote at all or that you will be any more.
And exactly, but internet voting is only one, or voting is only one way that we, you know, can express in our role as citizen. It may be, you know, the most visible and symbolically, obviously, it's quite important too. But I mean, like you were describing these citizen portals, right? That you have the opportunity to log on and access, you know, if you will, your own file of information that relates to how, you know, whether it's the taxes you've paid or the government services that may be available to you. Do a lot of people use that? Is that has that become a kind of salient, if you will, a new kind of public meeting space for people? I mean, that's the sort of thing that, you know, policymakers here or elsewhere, you know, might want to study because, you know, at the moment there is no easy single point of contact for the average citizen who might want that kind of thing. Here you have to go to various different government websites. You certainly can't aggregate all your citizen information in one place the way you could aggregate all your banking information in one place.
Right. Well, I think that,
there's a technical obstacle to it. So
sure.
What is it changing things for people there?
I think that one of the big things that we need to think about with respect to how technology is used, and not only in writing this book, but also living here in Germany, I think that we often need to remember what the cultural norms and values are of that particular place. So, you know, I talked about this digital ID card system and everybody having access to it and this kind of thing. And while I and you and maybe a lot of people on this call might think that, yeah, we should have that, you know, why wouldn't we have that? I would bet that if a member of Congress tomorrow proposed some kind of digital ID card system like that in the U.S., I imagine a lot of people would be very concerned about giving the government too much access to too many things at one time, you know, and that people would be a little bit wary. I mean, again, we barely trust in my home state of California. California, as you may know, certified and then decertified computer-based, not even internet, but computer-based voting, touchscreen voting, because people said, well, it can't be trusted. We got to have paper printouts, this kind of stuff. And there's this kind of cultural idea that somehow this isn't trustworthy. And so I think it would be a much, much harder sell in the United States, you know. In Germany, this kind of manifests itself in a different way. Last summer, some people may know, Germany got Google Street View for the first time. And you know, in the U.S., we've had Google Street View for I think, 4 years now. And, you know, there were no politicians that said anything, as far as I heard, when Google Street View came out. You didn't have major government officials talking about how this was a big invasion of privacy and how Google needs to respect people's rights more and all this kind of stuff. But in Germany, that's exactly what happened. You had cabinet-level ministers, the chancellor herself, Angela Merkel, talking about this. This was front-page news for weeks. And I find that really interesting that, that this was a big story here because of people's kind of cultural norms and what was accepted as private and not, versus in the United States where we just kind of shrugged our shoulders and said, okay, we got this new thing.
Right. Yeah. Well, maybe one of the people we'll have on the call, later this year after his book comes out is Jeff Jarvis, whose new book is actually, Public Parts is all about these cultural cultural attitudes about privacy and sharing.
Yeah.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to talk about Iran.
Sure.
I'm going to just pause for a second because to just see if there's anybody who wants to jump in with a question. The way to do that, folks, is to hit *6 on your phone, and then I can unmute you and put you right into the conversation here. But while we're waiting to see if anybody does that, talk to us about Iran. And in particular, I mean, the section on Iran in the book, I would say, in many ways, I mean, there's this amazing portrait of, a blogger, early Iranian blogger who you got to know very well, obviously, who describes his experience of actually being tortured for being a blogger. I see a call. I see a question in the queue here, so I'm actually going to open it up to that, since I'm very important to include other voices on this call. But let's make sure we talk about Iran. Hi, you're on the PDF Network call. Go ahead. Who's calling?
This is Michael Nelson. I'm a professor at Georgetown University and also with the Leading Edge Forum. And actually, my question was exactly what you were asking me. I bought the book. I have not had a chance to read the whole thing, but I bought it because of the section on Iran. And I was just had a particular question there, which was how important has the academic community been in getting the Internet into some of these countries? You know, here in the U.S., the academic community kind of was a leader in the 80s in getting the U.S. connected, and a few other countries around the world, including Korea, you can point to universities that really jumped on early. Do we see that pattern in Estonia, Senegal, and in particular in Iran? Has there been a role as the nonprofit sector, particularly the academic sector, in pushing the internet forward?
Yeah, what's really interesting, thanks for the question. I really appreciate your interest in this topic in the book. But yes, with respect to one of the things that I talk about, I mean, kind of basically the general I would say, point of the book is kind of, you know, how did we get to having Iran be the first country in the world to arrest a blogger? How did we get to Estonia having digital ID cards and digital voting and all this kind of stuff? And how did we get to South Korea being the world's most broadband country and so forth? You know, how did this all happen? So I talk a little bit about the development of the Internet in these countries in particular. And, yes, with respect to Iran, there was a professor he worked at the Institute of Physics and Mathematics in Tehran, and he was a kind of like a fellow exchange student while he was a graduate student in Italy I'd have to double-check my notes, but I believe it was in the 1980s. And he was first exposed to email, you know, just basic email. And he thought, you know, this would be great for our academics to be able to get plugged in with the international academic network and share papers and all the rest. And so he really pushed for pushed for Iran to be connected to something called, I believe it was ErnNet, and then eventually onto the ARPANET. It's really interesting, actually. What's kind of funny, and I this was one of my favorite kind of, I guess you could say, coincidences of history, is that in 1989, when the Internet was first approved for use in Iran, it was actually approved by one of the most Islamic conservative families in Iran. I just sent, for people who are following on Twitter, I just sent out the link to this. It was approved by a guy called Mohammad Javad Larijani, who at the time was the director of this thing I mentioned called the Institute for Studies in Theoretical Physics and Mathematics. And actually, his brother is is the current speaker of the Iranian parliament and was the former Iranian chief nuclear negotiator. And another brother is the head of the very conservative Iranian judiciary. And so I find it kind of interesting that, you know, all of these problems that the Iranian government is having now, you know, and many conservatives, you know, are trying to shut stuff down, you can trace it back to these same guys, you know, going back more than 20 years.
Mm. But the question, and Mike's question is a good one because it is about, you know, sort of how, you know, these connection technologies spread. And what I was hoping we'd get into with Iran is, you know, Iran, there was this period where the United States and in Europe, where a number of the sort of early, you know, blog evangelists, I'm thinking of people like Dave Weiner, Jeff Jarvis again, were really excited at the potential of, you know, the development of the Iranian blogosphere, right? And people embraced and supported bloggers like Hodor, you know, is in your book, and you know, the spread of blogging into Persian was, we were told, you know, going to be a factor in, you know, the democratization of Iranian culture. And obviously, it's a much more complicated picture. There are, you know, all kinds of blogs in Iran, including, you know, blogs written by the conservative mullahs and their supporters, written by people who are into Persian poetry and culture and have, you know, no political slant at all. So were the early enthusiasts mistaken? You know, again, I mean, this is sort of like a question similar to the one we started our conversation with about, you know, the role of ubiquitous internet in Korea. You know, how would you judge the impact of you know, the spread of networks and connectivity and bottom-up self-expression in a place like Iran? You know, where do you come down on this debate? You know, which won't get resolved in the next 10 minutes, but it's the debate over whether, you know, the internet is a democratizing technology or it's just a tool and, you know, in fact, the authoritarians can use it as well or better to keep control of their societies.
Yeah, this is a great question, and there's a lot to that. I mean, I think kind of the way I like to think about it is, I don't know if there's any X-Files fans out there, but I kind of feel like I'm in the position of Fox Mulder from the X-Files. And so for X-Files fans, you may remember that Fox Mulder has a very famous poster in his office, and it says, "I want to believe." He wants to believe in UFOs, but he doesn't quite totally. I kind of feel the same way with respect to democratization and the internet, right? I want to believe that that's true. I want to believe that the internet can bring about more democracy in a place like Iran or anywhere else in the world. But as of now, I don't. And actually, it's interesting because the original title of my book was going to be called Planet Internet, The Liberating Effects of a Wired World. That was the initial title. But as I dug into this, and I think as anybody does, if you know, as this has gone on and as governments like Iran, governments like China especially, have gotten more and more sophisticated about how they use the internet not only for their own propaganda purposes and for their own message and for their own kind of control and filtering and surveillance and all that kind of stuff, and we shouldn't also forget that countries you know, governments retain, in some cases, you know, the power of the judiciary and the power of violence at their disposal. You know, as we saw in the case of Iran, you have people who can be imprisoned or even killed for what they say online, or even put into exile. And so, I think we shouldn't forget that you know, yes, people like who I profile in the book, people like Omid, who live outside of Iran and you know, can write whatever they want online from the freedom of his apartment in San Francisco. You know, the fact of the matter is that he's basically been exiled from the country and doesn't really have a future in the country anymore. And so you have to ask yourself, I think, as those people get marginalized, do they become less relevant? As a generation ago, people of my father's generation, many of whom emigrated to Europe and to North America, you know, as they become marginalized, you know, who started satellite TV stations in Los Angeles and things like that. I don't know the answer. It's a really tough question. As of now, I would lean toward the fact that the internet, you know, has the potential to be a democratizing force, but it also has the potential to be a tool for surveillance and for oppression as well.
Mm-hmm. So the blog is not necessarily mightier than the sword. But what I mean, let's look at you know, where things are, you know, now in terms of, say, Iran or for that matter Syria. I mean, the outsiders are playing somewhat of a catalytic role in that, you know, I mean, some of the state control has been eroded. You know, YouTube videos continue to get out of Syria now. Satellite phones got in. And, you know, there's, I mean, obviously it's not technology alone that's keeping, you know, this movement alive, but people have, you know, if it's a cat and mouse game between the police and the dissidents, you know, to some degree, you know, I think we still don't know, you know, who's going to win. And, you know, I mean, I'm with you in that, you know, and I love that Fox Mulder image in wanting to believe but, you know, remaining skeptical. I mean, how, you know, I assume you're watching, you know, since finishing the book, you're watching developments in all these places with a great deal of interest. So what is your take? It would appear at least that connection technology has enhanced the capacity of pro-democracy activists, their ability to keep fighting, to last longer, and, you know, to regenerate, if you will, in part by the support that they can get from outside. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, that, you know, it's very, that definitely social media and the internet as a whole can definitely provide a boost, particularly for not only people on the inside of some conflict zone, whether that's Iran in 2009 or Egypt earlier this year, and also especially for people on the outside who can't, or who are struggling to get information as to what's going on. And passing around information to each other, helping with translation, things like that. I'm sure that that helps to a certain degree. But oh, okay.
Sorry about that.
It's okay. But for me, one of the big differences, you know, if we look at this Arab Spring that we talk about a lot, you know, for me, one of the big differences between Tunisia and Egypt on the one side, you know, the countries that had their authoritarian regimes fall in recent months, versus Libya and Syria on the other side, to me, one of the big differences there is the use of violence. And in Tunisia and Egypt, the Egyptian and Tunisian militaries did not fire on their own people, whereas in Syria and Yemen, forces shooting their own people. And that has nothing to do with the internet. That has to do with decisions by military commanders on the ground, you know. And, I mean, and yes, I'm sure there is some variability with who's on Facebook and who's not. Obviously, in Egypt, the military council thinks that Facebook is a valuable tool. They've recently, as I think many people know, they recently have set up their own Facebook page as a way to communicate their kind of press releases and messages to the people. You know, and so obviously they think that that is a valid way to do that. But you know, I wonder if there isn't. Like I was talking about a moment ago, if this use of violence and use of the judicial system as a way to kind of keep people down isn't often kind of stronger.
Yeah, no, I think you absolutely put your finger on probably the most salient difference of all. We haven't had time to get to talk about the fourth country that you cover in the book, Senegal. So I'm going to just give you a couple minutes to just say, you know, what the biggest takeaway for you is there. I mean, in short, a place where you've got some idealistic, forward-thinking leadership, but, you know, still a very poor and relatively speaking, you know, an education poor country. Yet I think we get a little bit of a picture of the potential for mobile to help the people of Senegal to sort of leapfrog over some of these obstacles. So say a little bit about,
no,
that, about that as we wrap
definitely
up
true.
The hour.
Yeah, so the reason why I picked Senegal, not only because I was a student there and was exposed to it some years ago, but Senegal is actually a really interesting place with respect to the internet. It is one of the best, I would say, best least connected countries in the world. The internet penetration rate, that is the number of people in that country divided by the number of people on the internet in that country divided by the number of people in that country, is around 10-12%. That's not the lowest in the world. It's not the highest. It's somewhere on the lower end of things. And so I wanted to find out, you know, and if you look on paper in Senegal, you would think that Senegal would be doing better with respect to the internet. It has a relatively high literacy rate of 40%. It has a stable government. It has a stable economic system. Its currency is actually tied to the euro. They're part of the West African franc that many countries in the region use. They happen to be also well-placed for these undersea data cables that flow right down the west coast of Africa. So Senegal, of course, is, if you can imagine a map of Africa, you've got Morocco, Mauritania, and then Senegal is right below that. So it's the westernmost part, right on the bulge right there. And so you would think, you know, you think, okay, they've got pretty good education, they've got a stable government, you know, they haven't had wars or genocide or famine or a lot of these things that, unfortunately, we hear about political unrest in other parts of sub-Saharan Africa, and yet internet connectivity remains relatively low. And there's been program after program, both from within Senegal and from outside of Senegal, from the United States even, that has tried to promote internet access. And basically, the two big reasons that I would say why the internet hasn't taken off as much as it has in other places in the continent, like Nigeria or South Africa, has to do with economies. It has to do with economics. As I said, most people can't afford computers, let alone internet access at home, and so it's difficult for people to pay for that. You can get DSL, you can get broadband access in many Senegalese cities, but it costs roughly what it costs in the U.S. or in Europe, you know, 30, 40 bucks a month. But when the level of income is so much lower, then that means that, relatively speaking, that cost is so much higher. So fewer people can afford it. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is education. So 40% of the people are literate. They're literate in French, which is the official language of Senegal. It's not many people's native language. It's the language of education and government and business. It's the language that you learn in school, but it's not. There are very few people, relatively few people, for whom French is their native language, the language that they speak at home and with their friends on the street and stuff. With respect to education, so 60% of the people are not literate. And if you're not literate, of course, you can't use the internet. So already right there, 60% out of Senegal's 11 million people can't use the internet by virtue of not being able to read and write. Right. And so you were talking about mobile. And yes, and I hinted at this a little bit in the book, and I think that mobile is really exciting in the developing world, very exciting in sub-Saharan Africa especially. In fact, it was Vint Cerf, one of the co-founders of TCP/IP, of the internet itself, said to me, I was fortunate enough to have him write the foreword to my book, and he actually said to me that you know, an entire generation of people in the developing world, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, as they are exposed to the internet for the first time, many people, not all, but many people will first experience the internet on some type of mobile device, whether that's right. An iPhone, whether that's another smartphone, whether that's a tablet, who knows what that will be, but the way that they will interact with it will be fundamentally different than I think the way that you and I and everyone else on this call interacted with the internet for the first time, which was with a keyboard and a screen. You know, and so you have applications that are starting to come up in Senegal a little bit. There's one, for example, where people can use their phones to text the price of various crops and things like that. There's another one that I'm really excited about that's happening in East Africa, in Uganda and Kenya, that some people might be familiar with, called M-Pesa. This is a mobile payment system that allows people to transfer mobile phone prepaid credit into cash, and you can transfer it very easily between one person and another and use it to pay your taxi, to pay your bills, to just lend money or borrow money or give money to people. And again, that's an example of a service that I think could work extremely well in the United States or in other parts of the world, but we haven't quite gotten there yet. Senegal is low with respect to internet connectivity, but yeah, I think that there is some reason for hope there. I should also mention, and this didn't make it into the book actually, but that within the last couple of years, Google has actually opened up, I believe it's half a dozen offices around sub-Saharan Africa, including in Senegal. And there, Google is sponsoring these Google Hack Days, and they're getting together programmers, teaching people how to program, getting together kind of startup communities in Ghana, Nigeria, and other places to try to really develop this kind of internet community for sub-Saharan Africa, which is pretty exciting. I mean, of course, Google has profit interest there as well, but I'd like to believe that some of it is to do good in that part of the world as well.
Yeah. Well, Cyrus, I wish we could stay on longer with you. We've actually consumed a whole hour, and I think barely scraped the surface of your knowledge of all the ways the internet is developing internationally. I want to ask, as we sign off with you, and in addition to your book, The Internet of Elsewhere, how can people follow your work? Where would we find you online? Give us the coordinates.
Sure. So it turns out I'm really easy to find on the internet because, as far as I can tell, there's nobody else online that's named Cyrus Farivar the way I am. So I'm very easy to find. Usually my online handle is C, my first initial, like Charlie, C, and then my last name Farivar. So C Farivar. C Farivar is my Twitter handle. My email address is cfarivar@cfarivar.org. You could find me using that on all your favorite social networks, Facebook and all the rest. And my website is cfarivar.org. We'll get you there. Cyrusfarivar.com will also get you there. And the website for my book is internetofelsewhere.com. You can order the book through Amazon or your local bookstore. This was tweeted earlier, but I'll mention it again. If you do go to internetofelsewhere.com, right up at the top there's a button that says Read. And you can read the first 15 pages as a PDF for free, totally free. So, put it on your iPad or Kindle or whatever. So that's available for people. And then, hopefully, maybe you'll like it and you can order it and check that out. So,
I heartily endorse that. Thank you, Cyrus, for your time and all your hard work on the subject. We'll be continuing to follow your work and hopefully we'll get you one of these years to speak at PDF.
We'll make it happen.
Absolutely. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, this has been the PDF Network conference call. We thank our sponsor, AT&T, for making these calls possible. And I should just say that given that it is now truly the summer doldrums, I'm about to take off a little time on vacation. I hope everyone else is enjoying a happy and healthy summer. We will be back with these calls after Labor Day. Stay tuned for a posting of the schedule. And until then, we'll see you online. Take care.
Thank you.